you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. The Twilight Histories is a storytelling podcast in the style of a campaign where you are the hero. Today, you're going to hear a story by Kevin Valbonesi called Seize the Fallen Crown. If you're a Dungeons & Dragons fan, you probably take it for granted that your group is going to have different types of characters with different strengths and weaknesses. Someone in the group will probably be a meaty barbarian. You may have someone playing a wizard. You'll probably have a sneaky rogue, and often you'll have a paladin to heal everyone up after battle. Basically, you have a well-rounded team, fit to meet any challenge. Whenever one of your teammates says they're going to play a bard, it's usually met with a collective groan. And I should know because I'm playing a bard in a game right now. Bards have a smattering of skills. They're not really strong in anything and tend to be a bit annoying with their songs and their ballading. Or at least I am. Well, listen, I found this hilarious podcast. It's called an actual play Dungeons & Dragons podcast, where everyone in the group plays a bard. The podcast is appropriately named Bombarded. And as I say, it's hilarious. What amps up the cool factor even more is that the players are all very accomplished musicians, and they add their music to the story as it goes along. So they are, in fact, real-life bards. Have a listen to this trailer for Bombarded, and then go and subscribe to it.
Hey everyone, I'm your host and Dungeon Maestro Kyle of the podcast Bombarded, a musical D&D adventure that our band Lindby from Dallas-Fort Worth puts on with an all-bard cast. I'm going to be taking my players, Yashi, Razzle Son of Dazzle, and Randy, through their education at Strumlot School for Bards, and we also cover the little misadventures that they encounter along the way. We're all bringing real instruments to the table so that we can perform our bard spells, and every episode we're going to be rolling chord dice so that you, the listener, gets a new song composed by the bards of Bombarded. Find out what musical mischief we're going to get into every other Tuesday. You can find us on social media by searching at BombardedCast, and of course, pick us up wherever you get podcasts by searching Bombarded.
That was Bombarded. Mark it down, subscribe, and join the fun. And now, on to today's show. This is Seize the Fallen Crown by Kevin Valbonesi.
You stand on top of a bridge, an axe in one hand and a dagger in the other. A cool, biting mist hangs in the air, making it almost impossible to see what awaits you at the end of this passage over the river. Still, glancing up, you can just about make out the outlines of the battlements which have frustrated you for weeks now. Standing tall, half hidden by the frigid curtain, you might think for a moment that it was the Jotun waiting for you with bated breath across the Seine. A call goes out from behind you, and you turn back to see the black wisps of smoke rising up from the hundreds of campfires still burning in the early hours of the morning. Here, too, you glimpse the vague outlines of shadowy figures stalking to and fro in the mist. And while nowhere near as tall as the stubborn battlements, among men, it would be fair to call them giants. Wandering into their midst, you get a clear view of the Norse, who heave timber, weapons, and roasted swine to their comrades, hundreds of them swarming about on the banks of the river. You join a particularly brutish-looking band, all squatting around their campfire, pulling shaggy cloaks tight around their barrel chests. Long beards, longer hair, and blue-green eyes greet you as you huddle by the fire and help yourself to a cup of mead. Much grumbling is in the air, and in particular, the titanic Gorm is making no secret of his displeasure. sending chunks of charred wood tumbling out from the campfire as he roughly tends to them with a large stick.
What a waste of sunlight. If I wanted to sit around and drink myself into a ditch, I would have stayed in Hethabir.
Gorm tosses the big stick into the midst of the flames, sending embers flying in every direction, earning him the scorn of everyone present.
Don't sit so close and you won't get burned. Would you stand in front of the walls of Paris and expect not to be shot?
Several rise to their feet, looking like wolves with teeth bared. Snarling, Gorm gets up, apparently in no hurry, standing a good head taller than everyone else.
All right. I could use a warm-up anyway.
Before anyone can come to blows, you spy a number of shadows approaching from the misty edge of the nearby forest. Emerging from the ethereal veil, you see a regal man dressed in embroidered robes and armed with a mighty sword, his sapphire-hued eyes discernible even at this distance, glimmering as if lit by hibernal flames. Behind this striking man, a number of shield maidens follow, lances and axes held in one hand, their titular shields in the other, and their hair tied in wild braids. Finally, at the very back of this procession, you see Christian monks in their dark robes, hands and throats bound, dragged forward by the shield maidens. The morning raids into the countryside have apparently yielded great fruit. Everyone bows at the approach of the great man leading the procession. Everyone, except for Gorm, who barely nods his head. A shock of utter disdain passes between the two men, but the more regal of the two, the man you know as Jarl Eriksson, lets it pass and greets you all with warmth. Though the Jarl stands a good inch or so taller than Gorm, he is almost angelic in appearance, with blinding blonde hair and radiant skin. For a warrior chief, the Jarl looks suspiciously tidy.
Greetings, friends. I bring great tidings. Although the walls of Paris continue to frustrate us, the countryside has proved a land of veritable spoils. Our magnificent shield maidens captured these Christians in their church. We have at least 10 able-bodied men to sell for slaves.
But not an ounce of gold, it seems, scoffs Gorm.
If you would let me finish, Gorm, I can relieve you of your worries.
Jarl Eriksson signals to the shield maidens, and they drag the group of bound monks over, forcing them to kneel in front of your comrades. They are all tonsured, filthy and beaten from their ordeal, and shivering in fear. All, save for one.
While there was very little in the church, one of these monks tells me that they have hidden their goods out in the countryside.
The Jarl points to the monk in question, a rather young-looking fellow with short black hair and an air of utter tranquility about him. The monk smiles and nods, greeting you all in perfect Danish.
Hello, I am Marcius.
Everyone looks stunned, intrigued more than anything. The monk nods to you all in turn and gestures towards the woods with his bound hands.
My brothers are obviously quite shy, given our circumstances, but I can assure you that there are many spoils buried out in the countryside. If you would spare our lives, I will happily lead you to our cache.
Gorm chuckles, sending flecks of spittle flying at Jarl Eriksson's face. He gestures to Marcius and continues to laugh.
You take the word of this Christian? Of course he'll tell you that there's treasure out there. And if there even is any, you think he would give it to you just on our good word?
Marcius raises his bound hands, fluttering his fingers to get Gorm's attention. He continues in Danish, leaving his fellow monks ignorant and struggling to understand.
Oh, you can kill us if you want. But Count Odo will see to it that you don't capture the Ile de la Cité. And, any day now, King Charles will likely arrive in force. So, why not spare a few moments to line your pockets? If I'm lying to you, it's my head and theirs, isn't it? Gorm shrugs his shoulders and turns away from the monk. Jarl Eriksson grabs Gorm by the shoulder and spins him back around.
Where do you think you're going? You want something to do? Take a few of these anxious souls with you and investigate the monk's claims.
Gorm stares down Jarl Eriksson, eyes burning with rage. All around the camp, you see and hear hands wrapping around axes and swords, followed by the shield maidens surrounding Gorm.
Paris will still be here when you get back, Gorm.
For everyone's sake, the loot better be too.
Gorm steps back, raising his hands to calm the camp. Grips loosen, seats are reoccupied, and deep breaths resound. Gorm casts his eyes around and then points to you and one of the other Danes.
I'll take these two, but I will be back right away.
You get to your feet, picking up your two-handed axe and slinging it over your shoulders, resting it against the hood of your cloak. The Dane, chosen by Gorm, Halfdan, picks up a pair of short swords and goes without so much as a word. You approach Gorm, and rather than greeting you, he shoves rope in your hands, the very rope holding Marcius tight. The monk bows to you, then offers a playful smile. You tug at the ropes, ensuring that they are in fact tight, and hoping to cut off that unsettling grin that the monk wears. "Which way, monk?" you ask. Marcius points roughly south, standing up and shaking his legs out in preparation for the long walk, still smirking the whole time. Jarl Eriksson steps aside, and the shield maidens part, offering your newly forged party an easy way out. Gorm leads the way, sparing no further glance at the Jarl or his retinue. Halfdan follows, as do you, though you are compelled to look back, if only for a moment. The mist has yielded somewhat, offering a clearer view of the walled city standing on the Ile de la Palais. The defiant bulwark stands surrounded by water, and just up the river, swarming the western banks like locusts descending on a field, are hundreds of Viking longships, anchored, grounded, or en route to what may very well be the second sack of Paris. Having forsaken, at least for a time, the spoils guarded by the walls of the old Merovingian palace, you instead wander about the barren woods which dot the Parisian countryside. Asphyxiated by the cold grasp of winter, the leafless branches of towering oaks, birches, and pines stretch out overhead to form a twisted and tortured canopy. Below your feet, the carpet of autumnal leaves crunches and cracks, setting everyone on edge as the unavoidable cue echoes throughout the forest. Even now, with the sun hanging overhead, blazing at its midday pinnacle, the glimmering veil of mist lingers, perhaps concealing hostile Frankish forces. Everyone keeps a weapon at hand, unwilling to be caught unaware by the soldiers or specters who lurk beyond the reach of sight. Only Marcius, who cannot be trusted with a blade, walks in utter serenity, leading your tiny raiding band through the mysterious veil. The monk moves with certainty, never stopping for even a moment, never second-guessing himself. It's as if he is the only one who can see the meandering trail which leads you deeper into the woods. He continues on in this effortless manner for what feels like an hour, and it's only upon your approach of a particularly dense thicket that the party finally comes to a halt. Gorm seizes the rope that binds Marcius from your hands and gives it a firm yank to stop the monk. Marcius pivots with grace and faces Gorm, still wearing an unsettling smile on his face. He bows to his Viking captor and looks on expectantly.
How much longer, monk? Jarl Eriksson was not gone so long when he captured you and your friends.
Well, yes, it wouldn't do us much good to stash our sacred relics right next to where you might plunder them. But we learned our lesson well after you heathens sacked Paris the first time. Marcius gestures to the axe that Gorm is squeezing in his other hand. Besides, if I was deceiving you, what difference would it make to have my head chopped off here or out there? Dissatisfied, Gorm yanks on the rope, causing Marcius to jolt forward. In a quick flick of his wrist, Gorm has the rope wrapped around Marcius's neck, and with a tug, he begins to strangle the monk. Though his face begins to go red, and the rope fibers are tearing into his flesh, Marcius does not bleed or even cease his incessant grinning. Gorm bellows, intent on making Marcius break. He tosses his axe aside, and seizing the rope with his free hand, he lifts Marcius up, attempting to strangle him. But the monk gasps for breath and kicks his legs about, but he keeps his eyes fixed on Gorm's, staring down death with a maddening grin. "Gorm, stop!" you shout. "Gorm! We'll get nothing if you kill him now. Stop!" Gorm just heaves Marcius higher, his bare arms flaring, his veins ready to burst from the exertion. Marcius's eyes look ready to burst out of his head. Panicking, you place the blade of your axe against Gorm's neck, startling Halfdan, but he casts his eyes back and forth in utter indecision. Finally, Gorm relents, dropping Marcius to the ground. But in a flash, he spins and knocks your axe out of your hand. Then, charging you, he seizes you and slams you against the trunk of a tree. You struggle to push him off, but he's simply too powerful. Gorm arches his head back and prepares to crush your nose against his forehead, but you shift at the last second, causing him to crack his head against the trunk of the tree. Thinking quickly, you kick at Gorm's knee, causing him to drop. This gives you the window you need to pop him square in the nose, causing him to fall back. Not wasting a moment, you scramble away from the hulking Norseman, seizing your fallen axe and preparing for round two, either from Gorm or Halfdan, who looks quite alarmed himself. You stretch out a calming hand towards Halfdan, though the gesture largely goes unheeded. You keep your weapon ready, expecting an assault from both sides. Clapping cuts through the tense silence. You all look over and see Marcius sitting cross-legged, doing his best to clap with his bound hands. He's smiling, eyes wide, apparently unaware of the ragged red ring now imprinted across his neck. "So, the runt of the litter is the most ferocious. I suppose you needn't be Charlemagne to put a barbarian in their place." Marcius keeps clapping and even starts bowing to you, but this only serves to enrage Gorm. Standing tall once again, blood pouring from his nose and painting his lips and teeth like the maw of some hellhound, he stomps towards Marcius, extending a thick finger in your direction.
"I'll take care of you in a moment, traitor."
As the hulking Viking draws near to Marcius, you try to rush in, but Halfdan leaps between you, his twin swords now extended out, blocking your way. He doesn't quite look ready to run you through, but you have no doubt that any attempt to pass him will compel a violent response. You consider the axe in your hand, and weigh the odds of overcoming the blades akimbo which now bar your path.
"You will pay for wasting my time, monk."
Gorm pulls a dagger from his waist and raises it high, ready to plunge it into Marcius's throat, or, hell, maybe even cleave off his head if he can. You try to go around, but Halfdan stops you, eyes pleading, but his body also signaling that one more attempt will get you shredded to ribbons. Gorm seizes Marcius by the collar of his cloak, steadies his target. But not a moment later, Gorm collapses back, landing flat on the ground and scattering the half-frozen leaves like the arrival of heaven's fleet-footed messenger on the banks of the Styx might scatter vengeful shades. The thud startles Halfdan, who spins around to see what's transpired, and himself collapses not a moment later. Falling down right at your feet, you can plainly see the arrow embedded in Halfdan's skull. You quickly drop your axe and raise your hands, praying that whoever has their next arrow knocked against their bow might spare you. A glance at Gorm's corpse reveals an equally accurate shot to that which felled Halfdan, with the assailant even managing to place their arrow through the bridge of Gorm's brow. You don't know if it's one or more archers out there in the mist, but the fact that just one of them has such terrifying aim is enough to keep you frozen in place. Marcius, on the other hand, is jumping for joy, leaping to his feet and helping himself to the fallen Gorm's knife. Cutting himself free, he tosses the blade aside and brushes himself off, taking a moment to massage the neck wound inflicted by his deceased tormentor. Even now, he has a jovial air about himself, and as his eyes meet yours, he's still smiling like a fiend. Oh, you needn't worry about yourself. You'd already be dead if that was my design. But I wouldn't say your ordeal is exactly over yet. If we don't all come back, the other Vikings will slaughter your brothers, you say, stating it more as fact rather than a threat. You're obviously in no position to be firm about anything. It is unfortunate, yes. And yet, a very necessary sacrifice given what is transpiring outside of the walls of Paris. Those monks shall become blessed martyrs, according to their creed, even if they do not know what they give their lives in service of. Marcius steps forward, gesturing for you to take his hand. You inch backwards, mindful not to make any sudden movements, lest you get an arrow fixed in your skull. Marcius gains ground on you faster than you can retreat. And now, as the grinning monk draws even closer, you begin to see the shadowy outlines of figures within the mist. They outnumber you at least 5-1, and they draw nearer every moment. But don't be afraid, my friend. We have great things in store for you. Marcius nearly has his hands on you, and this causes you to panic. You spin around, praying that the first volley of arrow misses. But no sooner than you've turned 180 degrees do you find a gauntlet-covered fist flying towards your face, followed swiftly by darkness. You drift in and out of consciousness, your vision hazy, with everything in front of you rendered as little more than a smear. Your body is limp, and you can feel a pair of strong arms on either side of you dragging you forward, your legs scraping against the frosty forest floor. You're not dead, at least for now. As the fogginess in your head dissipates, you are better able to survey your surroundings. You're in a moister part of the forest now, for the frail leaves are few and far between. Instead, you're being dragged along a muddy surface, perhaps near the edge of a river or a pond. The mist is extremely thick here, preventing you from seeing very far ahead. However, the poor visibility doesn't seem to trouble your captors, for they advance with chilling certainty. Marcius leads the way, his hood down and your axe in hand. On either side of you, hooded figures, perhaps masquerading as monks, heave you along the filth, their faces hidden in shadow. You try to look around a bit more, but beyond your immediate surroundings, there is little to see. Even if you were to overcome your captors now, you haven't the faintest idea of which direction you'd need to flee in. "Save your strength, friend," says Marcius. "Your ordeal draws near." Marcius twirls your axe around in his hands, whistling a cheery tune as he does. He continues on in this manner for at least another 10 minutes, until finally he stops in place, sticking your axe in the muddy ground for a moment. Your escorts heave you up under your feet, one of them giving you a good slap to ensure that you're awake. That certainly does the job, and now, fresh sensations flood in. Where before you'd only heard dead air, now you can make out the gentle lapping of water against a shore, and a howling gale that sounds like the lamentations of 1,000 wretched souls rooted in the acidic soil of Hell's Seventh Circle. Marcius waves his hands around in the air, beckoning to someone or something beyond the edge of the water. At first, you ponder how anyone might discern Marcius's signal, so thick and unyielding is the mist. But as you gaze harder and harder ahead, past the viscous mud and over the onyx water, some vague form reveals itself. You think you see some bulk in the distance, perhaps a mound, but as you focus your gaze on it even harder, the smoky edges become sharp and regular. But whatever it is, the form in the distance is definitely that of man's making. Atop the structure, you see the distinct light of a flame roar to life, and with it comes the trembling of the earth and the bubbling of the water as something rises up from the inky depths. A stone bridge breaks the water's surface and tosses aside much of the mud, offering you an easy passage across the water. Marcius picks your axe up and gestures for you to cross. Your escorts toss you down in the mud and give you a good kick, prodding you to get back up on your own 2 feet. You think about fighting back now, because once you cross that bridge, there is no turning back. You stand up and ready yourself, hoping that you have enough energy to resist. But then, you remember the archers from before, and how easily Great Gorm and Halfdan were laid out by a single arrow each. You have no doubt that those archers have been following you the whole time, and now, they may even have their bows drawn. Marcius tosses your axe over to you and signals for your escorts to step back.
Forgive the stern manner we used to bring you here, but we simply had to make sure things were done properly. There is an order to things, you see, and the rules which govern my fraternity are quite strict.
And what brotherhood is that, exactly? It's clear to me that you're no Christian, but I've spent enough time among the Norse to know that you're no pagan either. Marcius can barely contain his joy. He claps his hands and points at you.
You are more discerning than your fellow raiders. Indeed, my creed is a most ancient one. We worship victory, and we bestow her favor upon those who prove their worth.
Marcius gestures across the bridge to the structure waiting in the distance. The mist seems to thin around the structure, offering an even clearer view of it. Where before you merely saw a box, now you recognize the sturdy trunks of columns and the squat angles of a pediment. It's a temple, one made in the Roman fashion, one which appears to be sinking in the waterlogged soil of its tiny island.
If you are worthy, I invite you to prove it. I offer you and your kind the world, but you must wager something very dear in return.
You feel something behind you, and turning, you see cloaked archers assembling, forming a loose semicircle around you, standing just at the edge of the mist, faces hidden. They all keep their bows slung over their shoulders, their arrows in their quivers, and their hands folded together in front of them. You're surrounded, though they are making every effort to perhaps convince you that escape is possible. But the choice is yours, continues Marcius. Enter, and see if you can seize victory. Or go, but never speak of this place again. You'll just shoot me in the back if I try to leave.
Oh no, certainly not. You saved my life. I will bend the rules this one time, but I tell you again, if you leave,
you never breathe a word of this place. Or we will find you, and we will put an end to you. If I go in there... Marcius shakes his head and steps aside, again gesturing across the bridge. You look back at the specters who stand between you and the open labyrinth which awaits, should you choose to depart. Without aid of Ariadne or her thread, navigating back to the Viking camp would be an ordeal in and of itself. And returning there would certainly be no simple matter, even if you could cross the Parisian countryside. Returning without Gorm or Halfdan is certain to have consequences. Perhaps the blade of an axe, rather than an arrow in the back. Consider your options. Will you wander the misty wastes in search of some safe haven? Or will you wager your life on the trial Marcius has in store for you? The entrance of the temple seems to call to you, with the sudden appearance of dim flames illuminating the interior, casting a warming glow out over the sterile white and filthy black world outside. You grip your axe, steady your breath, and step forward. The bridge is slippery and narrow, so you're forced to take a rather measured pace. Marcius follows behind you, leaving behind his hooded compatriots on the shore. The two of you walk together, mindful of every step you take, and the obsidian water which laps against the bridge, slickening it, making progress even harder. Even getting to the halfway mark feels like an eternity. But eventually, you step off of the bridge and find yourself standing before the temple. Not a moment later, you feel the earth rumble and the water splashing about your ankles as the bridge sinks back into the depths of the lake. There is no turning back, and so you do not linger as Marcius beckons you towards the temple interior. Stepping inside, you find the temple bereft of any ornamentation or flourish, save for the fiery basins which light the interior, and a single statue of a man's head and torso emerging from the top of a boundary stone. The man's body is well cut, muscular, and his head bears the broken remains of what must have been a radiant solar crown. This lone statue aside, the temple is little more than a gathering space, surrounded by empty niches and pilasters. Why have you brought me here, monk? Your people have twice now appeared before the walls of Paris, and I have heard tales of raids in the Saxon lands, and even as far as Hibernia. Every army sent against you is routed, and you plunder the riches of foreign lands to feed your starving families back home. But the barren north has made you hard, and your gods reward sacrifice in the face of certain death. Such, I believe, are the qualities of a great nation. Marcius stops a moment and shakes his head. The Franks were once such a great nation. When they first crossed the Rhine centuries ago, my ancestors thought them little more than rabid hounds. But as my predecessors became decadent and spurned the values that once made them masters of the world, it seemed time to pass victory's favor onto a more deserving people. And so it was. For many centuries after, with great Charlemagne once again restoring the imperial dignity to these lands. Marcius stops smiling, his fingers curling back into fists so tight as to make his knuckles white. But that great king's progeny have repeated the mistakes of the Caesars in just a few generations. And now, once more, a savage people, with surprising virtue, stand at the gates of these great lands, perhaps ready to seize the crown which now lies in the gutter. So you're a traitor. You forsake your master the moment a stronger one appears on the horizon. No. I have no allegiance to Charlemagne's withering progeny. My allegiance is with the aegis which makes these lands great, and which makes its peoples prosperous. and I lament that her favor is currently withdrawn, causing much suffering to the innocent.
And what would you have me do? Become ruler of the Franks?
Anything is possible. But first, we must see if the great Terminus shall let you pass and embrace the goddess.
And with that, Marcius claps his hands, causing the floor and temple around you to tremble. Dust and loose stones fall from the ceiling, and the flames which light the temple undulate and rage. There is a great rush of air as the back wall begins to turn, revealing a semicircular cut that you hadn't noticed before. But the statue and the wall behind it spin away, replaced shortly by another sculpture. Now, you are greeted by a stone altar wrapped in withered vines and covered in dried laurel leaves. And behind it, the immaculately carved visage of a winged woman standing upon a globe, her hands outstretched, offering a palm branch in one and a laurel crown in the other. Her likeness is stern, but breathtaking, and the workmanship of her nameless sculptor is so flawless that you doubt a mere mortal had rendered her out of stone. She is victory personified, and her unyielding gaze is fixed directly upon you. Behind you, the doors of the temple slam shut, startling you. Spinning around, you see Marcius standing in front of someone else. Someone heavily armed. The monk looks to you with great expectation in his eyes and a subdued smile on his face. He stretches his arms out, mimicking the gesture of the goddess. Descend to the sacred arena, flawless victory, and witness the challenge of this raider from the Norse lands. Let us determine here and now if the crown should fall on the heads of these barbarians, and let this matter be settled in the art most pleasing to you, by combat. And with that, Marcius steps aside, wandering into one of the shadowy corners of the temple, nearly melting into the darkness. You turn your gaze towards the armed man standing there, the flames causing his armor to glimmer, particularly the golden mask which shields his face. Whoever this nameless soldier is, they stand as tall as Gorm, almost exploding out of the segmented armor which guards their torso. They wield a gladius and a large scutum shield, which is broad enough to cover their entire body, massive as it is. Standing there before you, in utter defiance of the time and place, is a Roman legionnaire, prepared to battle here and now. And so you ready yourself for the challenge ahead. You grip your axe tight and take a deep breath, and for a moment, turn inward, reaching into the depths of your soul to find that savage spark which will ignite the berserker soul famed among the Vikings. The odds are not in your favor, but that's never stopped the Norse, and it won't stop you now. Taking your first steps forward, you lock eyes with the mysterious warrior and prepare to spill blood in this would-be Colosseum.
That was Seize the Fallen Crown by Kevin Falbinesi. If you enjoyed this show, I happen to be building out a similar show called Labyrinth of Doom. Kevin's version is dark and gritty, while mine is a bit more comedic. Labyrinth of Doom is basically my attempt to capture the fun I have at the table when playing Dungeons & Dragons. So it's got the exploration, the fights, the nail-biting moments, and yes, even the jokes. The idea is you're a Bloodsport fighter from the Twilight Histories universe, and you're looking for an adrenaline-filled adventure. You're given the costume of a Turkish Janissary, and are sent to an alternate version of the Dark Ages, where someone created a nasty, supposedly impossible labyrinth, and they're promising a huge reward to anyone who can finish it. The fun part is, I have no idea how this story will end. Your character might get the treasure, or maybe even die. I don't know. It all depends on how you vote. Yes, that's right. At the end of each show, I'll leave you with a challenge, and you get to vote on what happens to this Janissary. So how do you vote? First, sign up as a patron of the show. Then listen to the episodes in order until you're all caught up. Finally, you can vote. So go to twilighthistories.com and click through to our Patreon page. That's twilighthistories.com. Before you go, one of my friends, Roberto Mendez, has finally created a podcast. Years and years ago, he and I met somehow through our common interest in history podcasts. I think maybe he heard my show in the early days and we just got to chatting. I can't remember. But whatever happened, I do remember that we agreed that we needed a forum for history podcasters and fans to meet. Thus was born the History Podcasts group in Facebook, and Roberto is my partner in helping me moderate it. Well, after all these years, Roberto Mendez has finally created a podcast. It's called the History of Portugal Podcast, and he's doing it right. The sound quality, the production values, the writing, it's all excellent. Check out The History of Portugal by Roberto Mendez.
Hi, and welcome to the introduction of History of Portugal. I'm your host, Rob Mendez, and thank you for tuning in to this show's launch announcement. The purpose of today's episode, other than to let you know that the show is on its way, is for me to tell you a little bit about how I'm planning on doing this show. So, I think the first question to answer is, why did I start this podcast? Well, as far as I can tell, Portuguese history in general isn't widely known. Which is a shame, because it really is an interesting and captivating story. And I think that it's a story worth knowing. So, I want to share it with as many people as possible. After all, Portugal and its people have had a big impact on the world. And that can be illustrated by the fact that Portuguese is the official language of 9 countries and is the 5th most spoken language in the world. How did that happen? Why did it happen? Portugal's role in the so-called Age of Discoveries is probably its most well-known historical era, and we will cover that at some point. But there's a lot of history before that, and I cannot wait to dive into it and share it with all of you. A quick note on pronunciation. I will do my best to pronounce the names of people and places in their native language. But this is a show geared towards English speakers, so there will be exceptions here and there. For example, I will say Lisbon instead of Lisboa. You know, that kind of thing. So what will the show be like? The show will follow a chronological narrative beginning in the year 800 BC. I chose to start in the year 800 because I really want to showcase the layers upon layers of history that the Iberian Peninsula has accumulated. Much like building a house, we need a firm foundation before we start throwing walls up. With that said, I will begin this narrative with a broad strokes approach, running through about the first 1,000 years of history in just a few episodes. We will then begin to slow down in the 8th century with the beginning of the Muslim conquest of Iberia, as this pivotal event marks the beginning of the processes that will lead to the formation of Portugal. And honestly, Muslim Iberia is a time and place that is just endlessly fascinating. So I hope you will join me on this journey, starting on the 21st of October, as we begin to examine Portuguese history, starting from its deepest roots.